The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we're back from New York and Washington, D.C. It was a great trip, but I know you have Treasury yields on your mind right now.
I think we may end up sounding like broken records at some point, Kevin. It's a Treasury crisis. It's a Treasury crisis. It's a Treasury crisis. Mm-hmm. As I look at the next couple of years, it seems very obvious to me that that's where most of the pressure is played out in the marketplace. And there's a bunch of things that we want to talk about today, Kevin, but pretty significant is the 30-year bond market, where you've had the yield, the interest rate on 30-year bonds, rise above the 80-week moving average. We're above 4.75. That's 4.75%. Mm-hmm. And as we've been saying for months now, Kevin, 5.25 to 5.5 is sort of the definitive line in the sand, in my opinion.
The tipping
where
point.
You go past that. I mean, we've already made a significant technical move above the 80-week moving average, which is a long, long-term moving average,
right,
technically speaking. But 5.25 to 5.5 sort of seals the fate for the U.S. Treasury market. And just to restate why it's important, the direction of U.S. Treasury yields, this is the cost of capital. This is what it costs you to borrow money long-term. And it is also a great litmus test for how people feel about the stability of your credit as a country.
Right. So the more unstable they feel it's going to be in the future, the higher the interest rate borrower has to pay.
Exactly. It's a penalty rate for what they view as a greater probability of default.
Right.
And if there's no probability for default, then you see that rate squeezed to an insignificant number. And if there's a higher probability of default, then you see that number increase or escalate over time. There's two issues to this. One is that as interest rates rise, it costs you a bigger number in terms of the interest on the national debt.
Right.
But the other issue is that anyone who owns bonds and purchased them in an area where interest rates were low begins to see the cash value of their bonds diminish significantly. You could see over the next 10 years a bond portfolio beyond intermediate to long-term bonds diminish by 30 or 40 or 50%.
Just with interest rates going up a few
percent. And I think the general assumption by most investors is that's volatility that you only see in the stock market. As a quote-unquote conservative investor, that's why I've bought bonds, that investor may say, and would be surprised and amazed to see capital losses at the level or to the proportion that we might see over the next 5 to 10 years. But what I'm saying, Kevin, is that we are at a turning point. What we've been saying for almost 2 years is that we are at or near the turning point, and I just can't express how important this is. What is the straw that breaks the camel's back? You know, we've certainly got municipal bond issues, and we'll talk about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just explore some of the backdrop issues for our economy before we get started, and I do want to spend some time talking about D.C. and New York and some observations that we made from our most recent trip back to the East Coast.
Okay.
We have the Institute for Supply Management numbers, which have skyrocketed from 28 to over 50, and it puts our inventory numbers, Kevin, at levels we haven't seen since 1984.
Okay, so when there's high inventory, what you're saying is the retail stores, they've got a lot of product, but they're not necessarily selling a lot.
Exactly. We're not seeing follow through in terms of retail sales, but we certainly have industries gearing up for recovery. And the question is, do we have recovery or do we not? If we have recovery, then this is a stroke of genius and they're getting product onto the shelves at just the right time. But I can tell you from ordering a piece of furniture that just arrived yesterday and it took 6 months to get to us, that in many companies, they don't have anything on the shelves, and they're waiting for the order before it's manufactured. So maybe we're talking about smaller item issues that they're loading the shelves with, but the reality is there are a certain number of corporations, a good number of corporations, who are now making a commitment. They're making inventory commitments that I think are going to be problematic by the time we get to the end of the year.
So if you don't have a recovery, obviously that's dead capital. That's capital that's sitting there that's not moving off the shelves.
And it's cash that should have been kept in the war chest for times just such as these. Again, assuming that the recovery is not here. Kevin, it's not just the U.S. that is under pressure. As we talked about a few months ago, PIMCO has pulled the plug on a significant part of their U.S. bond holdings. This is the largest bond manager in the world, and they have, along with BlackRock, been a very significant player in partnering with, you could say, the last two administrations. As we've come through this financial crisis, two names that you've seen in the subscript have been BlackRock and PIMCO. They're very well politically connected, and yet even though they're politically connected here in the U.S., they have pulled a significant amount of money out of their main fund and out of U.S. Treasuries.
PIMCO, the size of PIMCO is the size of many countries or greater than that. So it's a large amount of money. When PIMCO moves, Bill Gross and the guys, one direction or another, it has an effect.
They manage in assets what the Chinese have in terms of U.S. bonds. You know, $800 billion. I mean, it's a lot of money. So their issue is not just with the U.S., but they're getting very vocal about British bonds as well. Instead of treasuries, they call them gilts, which I don't know if that's an indication of.
Unintended, I guess.
Yeah, how do you feel about your paper? The concern is twofold. One, that higher rates are coming. And why are higher rates coming? Because inflation is nigh. And so again, I mean, we can pretend that inflation is the boogeyman that will never be here, but some of the best and brightest in the bond world are looking and saying, whether it's U.S. treasuries or British gilts, we're concerned about higher rates, we're concerned about inflation, and we're concerned about debt downgrades. These are countries that have their work cut out for them.
Well, so, you know, David, I was just thinking as you were talking about this, I mean, there's a concern for inflation. There, we talked about the inventories being high, but unemployment continues to be a huge issue. How in the world are we going to go into a recovery with unemployment what it is right now?
Yeah, U6, which I think is still a reliable middle-of-the-road number, U3 is the official number that's reported, just under 10%, 9.8 currently. Mm-hmm. U6 is all of the old numbers that used to be reported as the real an official number.
Including people who have been out of work for the last year or so.
That puts you at 16.9.
Wow.
And then the SGS number, or the Shadow Government Statistics number put out by Mr. Williams, is still at about 21.7. Is it 21.6 or 21.7?
It's very close to what the Depression was back in the 1930s.
21.6, 21.7. Yeah. Let's just call it, yeah, pretty close to 25%, which we had in the Depression. You know, we struggled, Kevin, as we were looking around Washington, D.C., and the number of tourists visiting the Capitol, and New York City, particularly Times Square, struggled observing how many people are there. Is this just an indication of a yet-to-be-maxed-out credit line? And you observed while we were there, I agree with you, this is a belief system that dies a very slow death.
Right.
The belief that we'll be fine tomorrow, it's just important to keep a positive attitude. Well, it's very American, very noble, and it's one of the things that allows us to recover in many instances. Mm-hmm. In the context of a credit market collapsing, it ends up being a little naive instead of bold and brave, and instead of the poise of the boy on the burning deck, it ends up being the boy who was burned on the deck.
Right.
Which is sad and could have been avoided in this case. But I look at the number of consumers who are out in force, and, you know, at least, and again, this is just more of a sociological comment. This doesn't come back to any hard statistics, because the hard statistics would still say retail sales are off. But if, as we looked around, there were a ton of people moseying around Times Square.
They were spending money, yeah. Now, Dave, on going back to unemployment, though, I mean, we're hearing that unemployment, the situation's getting better, but in reality, isn't that a lot of changing of statistics? You were talking about the hard statistics, but the changing of statistics and the modeling takes and adds things where needed, does it not?
Well, precisely. The birth-death modeling is adding, for the last month, 81,000 jobs.
Oh, where'd they come from?
Even while ADP, who is responsible for payroll services, ADP actually counted. On the one hand, you've got the modeling,
right,
which says, oh, we added 81,000 jobs.
Which modeling, is very DC-esque. I mean, as far as Washington, D.C.,
what does your model tell you about growth and employment? Well, according to my model, it shows that we would have added 81,000 jobs.
Right.
But ADP is actually counting the number of people who were fired and are off their payroll service, and it's 112,000 lost in the same period. So, again, you've got this disparity between the public and private sectors and the numbers, which end up being, well, shall we say, on the one hand, politicized, and on the other, They're just trying to figure out what's happening and what we can do about it.
Well, I noticed the administration jumped on it. Obama said that the recovery is definitely in force. So
that's encouraging to know. Alan Abelson last week was pointing out that 54% of recipients of unemployment benefits have just seen their benefits expire. So with the exhaust rate, or if you want to call it that, is now at 54%.
Wow.
So in terms of the impact of a recession, you've got these temporary things, which do people have to stop going to Baskin-Robbins or Haagen-Dazs for ice cream on a Saturday afternoon with their kids immediately? No, not if you still have unemployment benefits coming through. You realize you're probably going to have to cut back in some non-critical areas.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing, Kevin, on the March unemployment numbers is this. Again, going back to the idea that these things are, on the one hand, in the public sector, they're modeled. In the private sector, they're counted.
Right.
The models showed that for March, there was 264,000 jobs. This is in the specific category of men over the age of 20. 264,000 jobs gained. Actually, it was 290,000 jobs which were gained, but when you suck out the 42,000 jobs lost and a few other numbers in there, we end up having a net number of 264,000 jobs gained, almost all of them coming from men over the age of 20. Again, you have 42,000 jobs lost, women over the age of 20. And what's blisteringly naive about this is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is assuming that people, if they see these numbers, will not say, this is absurd. You're literally playing with categories. You're not counting numbers. You're not playing with reality.
Well, if you were a fifth or sixth grader who was in math class, the numbers don't even add up or subtract right. You'd fail.
Well, I'd like to see the National Organization of Women out in arms over something like this.
Right.
Because if this is reality, and U.S. jobs, small business owners just hired 264,000 men but fired 42,000 women at the same time.
Something else is awry.
Something else is awry.
Yeah.
The point being is it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics spewing the same level of BS that they have for years, and it is politically motivated.
Yeah. Well, you know, on that subject, Dave, as far as the unemployment goes, we've seen that tax receipts are going way down. I mean, what's the outlook for municipalities right now? These guys are running out of money as well.
I remember sitting in Seattle almost 2 years ago with a gentleman, multi-million dollar portfolio in municipal bonds.
Hmm.
And my counsel to him at the time was, there's very few people heading for the door right now in municipal bonds. It would be prudent for you to trim back your municipal bond exposure.
While there's still a buyer in the...
While there are buyers. If you go back, there's certain times in the interest rate cycle, in the credit cycle, where bonds become very hard to sell. And I think we will see that within the next 5 to 10 years, where the assumption that it used to be AAA credit, AAA paper, and now it may be downgraded to AA or single A, which is not the end of the world, but you're assuming that there's still a market for it.
Right.
I think people who bought what they consider to be solid paper will be left in the same kind of lurch we saw in 2008 with money market funds, where redemptions were suspended temporarily. Money market funds. I mean, again, you assume it's the same as cash until it's not the same as cash, and you have to reorient your understanding and recalibrate. And I think that recalibration is in the process of occurring in the municipal bond market, Kevin, because we're looking at states and municipalities going from bad, not to worse, but from bad to desperate. And how are they going to have enough income to deal with their bloated budgets?
Well, that brings up a good point, Dave. They don't have the income to pay for what they've already committed to. So is there some sort of bailout in the wind as far as, I mean, would you be surprised if the government, the federal government, even came in and bailed these guys out, the whole too big to fail type of attitude?
Without a question, Kevin, there has to be municipal bailouts. Now, does the municipal bailout get a person out at 50 cents on the dollar, at 70 cents on the dollar, at 95 cents on the dollar? I mean, what is the real risk to a municipal bond buyer or owner in the midst of a bond bailout? Do they swap municipal paper for treasuries? What games are played in the midst of this?
You wonder what states are actually going to get the bailout. We saw with Wall Street, some guys won, Lehman lost.
Right. So which states win and which states lose?
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it past any administration, whether it's Republican or Democrat, to favor the red states or the blue states,
yeah,
depending on what makes the most sense? And perhaps there's a way to send a message. You know, do you really want to be suing the federal government over this particular piece of legislation? That's fine. You may proceed. We'll get back to you in terms of the municipal bailout.
Well, and we actually saw that before the health care bill was passed. I mean, we saw payoffs coming to certain states to win their votes.
Right. If we fail to realize that corruption has been endemic in Washington for a long time and has just now been underscored, emphasized, and perhaps italicized, you know, by a Chicago influence, I think we're naive. This is politics. What I'm saying is that politics doesn't give unless there's something on the other side that you're going to get. I mean, there is quid pro quo. There has been for 150 years. The fact that it's in bold type versus non-bold type at certain time frames, you're talking about the same thing, and it's not a Republican versus Democrat issue. If you don't get something, you're not going to give. So in the midst of the municipal bond bailout, what does the federal government gain? What power and what strings come attached with the money? Again, it's just federal tax dollars and IOUs, but what strings are attached at the state level with those federal bailouts? I think that is an interesting story to develop over 2010 and 2011.
Well, you know, another interesting thing, a guest of ours, Rick Bookstopper, has recently become very, very vocal about the municipal bond issue. I mean, well, what's he saying right now?
Yeah, and we covered this with him last time he was on the program, that commercial real estate and mortgage-backed securities are huge. But he's gone so far as to say, if you thought that was the big kahuna, you just wait.
Yeah.
The municipal bond debacle is off the charts. And I think it just pays in some instances to be early. Just like the conversation that I had a few years ago with the gentleman with a healthy-sized municipal bond portfolio. He needed to be early in order to have not only liquidity, but the full price, and even in some instances, premiums paid on the bonds that he owned. Instead, in question, I think, over the next year to two is the discounts and whether or not they're liquid at all. Any asset is liquid. The reality is any asset
at a price
is liquid. That's the issue. It's at a price.
How much are you willing to lose? Well,
yeah.
You know, and you talked about at the right time, there are some things you can't speed along. I can sell a municipal bond right now if I think things are going to change. But until I retire, let's look at Social Security. Social Security is something that you have no access to until you reach that particular point in life. Now, it's looking right now like they may not have what we, I mean, this is no news, but it really is looking like they may not have what they said they would have.
Well, and again, this comes back to a lack of integrity with numbers. When you model things out and make certain assumptions, Social Security shortfalls weren't supposed to happen until 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Social Security shortfalls are going to be this year, by the end of this year, to the tune of $29 billion.
Okay, so we've hit the date far earlier than what they said.
Yeah.
We're 7 years early.
And all it was the difference in a model, because the model said that we'll have, at most, an 8.2 to 8.8% unemployment rate, and it's been over 10%.
Well, and it's probably twice that.
Well, but again, that's the difference between the numbers you care to look at and the numbers you really should look at, the difference between U3 and U6.
Mm-hmm.
For a business manager or an executive to ignore the U6 number at 16.9 and assume that 9.8 reflects reality, even assuming 9.8 puts Social Security in a shortfall position now.
Wow.
Versus 2017. And this is just a few percentage points. So what happens when you massage numbers? This is like, Kevin, when you tell a small lie, and then in order to cover up a small lie, you have to tell a different lie. And you find that over a 6 to 12 to 18 month period, you have a life that is fabricated on the basis of one misstep. That is, I think, government to a T. On the basis of a few initial missteps, you have something which is almost identical to the Madoff scandal.
Yeah.
It is an entire fiction. Government is an entire fiction based on realities, which, is it real? Is it not real? Well, you and I would say, would at least suggest, we don't think so.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Well, you know, speaking of fiction, I mean, let's face it, when somebody says, well, Social Security is going to have a shortfall, or the municipal market's going to have a shortfall, or people need health care, the answer really all boils down to just printing more fiction until the inflation shows up. But I mean, even the European central banks now are responding. They're starting to buy gold, not dollars. I mean, there's been a trend change there, hasn't there?
I read a lot of different people, Kevin, and one of the recent comments from Dennis Gartman, who puts out a great daily commentary. It's very expensive. It's a worthwhile, for a professional money manager, it's a worthwhile read. Gartman's been pretty negative on gold.
Mm-hmm.
And at this comment, that's why this comment surprised me, because what he was looking at was a significantly greater purchase of gold by central banks over the next few years, because the euro, as an alternative to the dollar, is no longer attractive. And so, I mean, he's been sort of the gold skeptic for some time, expecting it to go lower. And this is sort of his about face, saying, well, it's the euro. The euro is not going to make it into the reserve assets of central banks globally, because it's very uncertain. I mean, depending on whether it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, and depending on whether it's the first week, second week, third week, or fourth week of the month, we have different opinions as to whether or not Greece is going to default or not.
Right.
The solution today is not a solution tomorrow. The Germans are not agreeing to it. The French are. The Germans are agreeing to it. Now the French are not. It's this back and forth. And what happens with central bank managers is they basically say, we don't know. The only thing we can say is that we don't know what the euro is going to look like, but I don't think it's going to be positive. What do we do with our reserve assets? Where do we have liquidity? What do we want as an alternative to the dollar? Because now you have two things that you're responding to. Dollar negativity. We don't want any more dollars. And growing euro negativity, which means you have to find an alternative. What's that going to be? Turkish lira? I don't think so.
Contrary to what the central banks have been doing for a decade or two, they're actually net buyers of gold this year.
Significant transition from last year, and what Gartman is providing is the motivation and the reason for why that continues in 2010 and 2011, because they need an alternative to both the two best alternatives out there up to this point, U.S. dollar and the euro.
Well, David, I know the euro has been on everyone's mind who are watching these situations with Greece and Italy, Spain, Portugal. We've decided that we need to try to go to the top and find out, you know, just from the very top, how the euro is going to behave over the next few years, or really what the history is of the euro.
Several times this last year, we've had commentary from England on the euro and on things relating to the continent from Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who was there on the ground for the first several years that the euro was created as a critic. The conversation we have this next week will be a little bit different, because rather than have a critic on the line, we're going to have one of the architects on the line. Otmar Ising has more tenure with the European Central Bank than any other figure alive today.
Yeah.
He was the only person, and this included the president, who had an 8-year term. Everyone else had a shorter term in their
So, David, that's next week. That will be the interview for next Wednesday.
Yeah, I think the things that we want to explore in sort of preview are the key dates, the things that were happening, the things they were trying to address in the architecture of the euro as a monetary union, the purposes, concerns that Mr. Ising had even at the time when he came and was hired in 1998, the concerns that he maintained up until he ended his tenure there in 2006, and some of the current hiccups, the things that were expected, where debt to GDP could not be over 60%.
Mm-hmm.
They had a number of criteria if you were going to come into the euro as a member.
And those criteria are being challenged right now by a number of countries.
And what's funny is they're not necessarily being challenged in terms of the entry of new people in, because that bar still exists. If you want to come in, then you have to reach this particular hurdle. But for anyone who is in, the question is, I mean, we've blown through those numbers
what
already.
What do you do when you blow the number?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the penalty?
Exactly. If your deficit is 12% and it was supposed to be 3, well, you overshot the number just a little bit, as is the case in Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal. The interesting thing, Kevin, is when you look at the numbers, the exchange rates for those countries when they were originally coming in and the exchange rates were set, the conversion rates out of francs and pesetas and pounds and lira and guilders and shillings, what you'll find is the ones who are the greatest offenders today – were the ones that had problems historically with inflation. The Spanish pesetas, 1 euro equaled 166 pesetas,
mm-hmm.
compared to, you know, the Finnish at 5.9. Big difference.
Yeah.
Or the Italian lira. 1,936 Italian lira for 1 euro.
Yeah.
Okay. Was there any indication before the euro was even started?
Who was inflationary?
Who was inflationary? Yeah. Who would not be able to keep numbers in line unless there was some fudging going on? Mm. Namely, off balance sheet items, the kinds of things that Goldman put together for a number of these countries, you know, to basically remove debt and allow their numbers to look prettier than they actually were. I mean, we're talking about criminal activity. This is a law. These are treaties which were signed onto, and to obfuscate the truth, you're talking about real issues. But be that as it may, we'll carry on a conversation without more icing that explores some of these things and perhaps the challenges that the euro has going forward. Is he as positive today about its prospects as he was in 1998? What are his primary areas of concern, not as a critic, but as an architect?
I'm looking forward to it.
Interestingly, Kevin, this last week, we had a conversation with a business school graduate from India who had spent time in Germany. One of his assignments was in Germany and had spent time in 15 different countries, actually. So a very global perspective, very insightful, 30 years old, and well-versed with general macroeconomics. And what was surprising to us was the very matter-of-fact and common-sense approach that he took to our U.S. Treasury market and our U.S. debt problems.
Well, and just to frame that conversation, David, we were out on the lawn, out in front of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and he was listening to our conversations and was extremely, well, I would say he was probably more informed than most Americans on, you know, what our deficits were, what the health care bill was. You really could not bring up anything that he didn't have some working knowledge on, and he said it was because it affected him in India.
Yeah, I take an interest. He said something to the effect of, I take an interest in what happens in America because I have something to gain or lose. And he asked a question just before we parted. Don't Americans take an interest in these things? Don't they have something to gain or lose? And I think it struck all of us, there is a gross amount of apathy and complacency across America when it comes to public policy, mm-hmm. the state of our economy, or any other of the issues of our day. And yes, they absolutely, Americans do have something to lose, but this is a part of the issue we're addressing in this year's DVD. And just conversationally, you and I talk about it all the time, the cult of specialists, where we trust someone else with a PhD or, you know, 20 years of experience with a name brand company, a name recognizable company, to say, well, he's the person who I should be trusting on this issue. I defer to him. And again, are you an economist? How long have you worked with the IMF? What's your background with the Fed? Do you teach history at Yale? There's a certain number of things that if your pedigree is clean, then whatever you say is golden. And that's the problem, is we are a people who are so over-involved in the stuff of life, whether it's dropping the kids off at soccer practice.
Sure, the distractions.
Legitimate, good things, you know, but stopping off at the store and picking up an extra gallon of milk. It's the harried, hurried tyranny of the urgent. Everything is urgent to us, and everything is a priority, that some very, very important issues get pushed out, get crowded out. And even though we do have something at stake, as this young Indian man was saying, we don't have time to care. And we're leaving it to politicians who respond exclusively to special interest groups and lobby groups because they're the only ones giving a voice and saying, here's what we think and here's what we want done on our behalf. And so essentially America has become driven by these special interests and lobby groups.
Instead of driven by the individual. I mean, the representative government that we have, you really feel when you go back and look at the history of it versus where we are now, that the individual voice is no longer heard. It's the special interest voice, or it's the large bloc, voter bloc. Whatever's the largest union or what have you is going to get the vote.
But I think that in part is because we as a culture have adopted this sort of specialization dependency.
And it relegates responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, if I looked at a company, a well-run company like a JPMorgan Chase, within, you know, a group of economists, you've got 50 different economists, and they each specialize and focus on one specific thing within the field of economics. I mean, it's a specialization within a specialization within a specialization. The old adage, you know, more and more about less and less until you know absolutely everything about absolutely nothing. That describes our world today as people have specialized and gotten so concentrated. And being in Washington, you feel that. You feel the weight of bureaucracy around you. You feel everyone having a particular role, and they're responding to a particular plea from a particular special interest group. But gone are the days of sort of a general awareness. And I got to tell you, I was very impressed with this young man. Lives in Mumbai.
He was only there for 2 or 3 days.
Only there for 2 or 3 days, yeah. But he was better informed about American issues than 98% of Americans. And it harkened back to a novel, this is probably 15 years ago, that I read, Mark Halperin's Memoirs from an Ant-Proof Case, where you have this economist who is paid by this bank to not be a specialist, but to travel the world and to watch people in cafes, to have conversations with cabbies, to learn what he could about economics from a very low level, if you will, but a very approachable common sense on the street level. Not unlike, you know, the investment biker that Jim Rogers wrote,
right,
you know, 20-odd years ago, where he travels around the world on a BMW motorcycle and, you know, is figuring out that the official interest rate in a particular African country is completely wrong. And how would he know that? Because the black market rate really tells you what the rate is.
And it took being on the street and understanding it from that level. In fact, you know, it reminds me of a story that this Indian man told us, that some of the things that Americans don't know, Kellogg's apparently had sold cornflakes in India.
Oh, they launched a massive campaign in India, and in the first week sold a ton of cornflakes.
Right.
And in the second week, cornflake sales dropped by 96%. Because even though this company has vast resources, guess what they forgot to do?
Indians don't eat their food cold.
So cold milk doesn't work. Beyond the initial splash, you don't eat cornflakes. And so they actually had to reconfigure the cornflake recipe to be something that could be eaten
after warm milk was poured on it.
After warm milk was poured on it, and it got all soggy and whatnot. So, I mean, but again, if you're not on the ground, if you don't have sort of a street level approach to economics, I think there's a lot of things that you do miss. And this trip to DC and this trip to New York are, I think, helpful. And as we travel around the country and around the world each year, it's helpful for different insights. I remember going through Dubai, taking the taxi from the Dubai airport to the hotel. We arrived at night, and to see a black skyline. You go to any major city in the world, and there's lights on every floor. And yet here is a city landscape full of high-rises and no electricity. And so, I mean, again, it's one thing to look at the numbers put out by, you know, the Dubai Business Chamber of Commerce, whatever. To be there is a little bit different. And to be in Washington, D.C., I think is, you really do experience that it is the center of the universe as far as the D.C.ites are concerned.
But didn't it feel very disconnected, the people who were in D.C.? They seem very disconnected from anything outside of that little world.
Disconnected from the arguments relating specific to the policies that were being discussed, very disconnected from the problems that those policies were supposed to solve. And you certainly see that, Kevin, coming full circle to the bond market, and we'll just close with this. In the last 24 hours, one of the most significant events of my lifetime pertaining to nuclear proliferation or non-proliferation has occurred. We just played one of the most significant hands of cards with the international community we could have played. We just told Japan, Taiwan, Germany, Israel, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia that we did not have their backs. And the quid pro quo of the post-World War II period, wherein we provided a shield of protection for our allies, which was a part of our nuclear policy,
right,
which was, we have you covered. Lock, stock, and barrel, we've got your back. We just walked away from that by saying, we will only launch a nuclear first strike or a nuclear strike in response to a nuclear attack on the United States. And I can tell you, from a liberal perspective, this is brilliant and beautiful and moves us towards a peaceful and glorious world where there's no longer the threat of warfare or the threat of mutually assured destruction.
Right, but from a strategic, realistic point of view.
But from a realistic and a strategic... Oh, it's absolutely, because the prisoner's dilemma, wherein mutually assured destruction and no one knowing what the outcome will be, has in fact ensured peace in our day.
Right. We have not had a nuclear war. We haven't had a use of a nuclear weapon since the end of World War II.
Right. And that's gone. And here's the significant thing. The reason why I preceded this with saying this ties directly into the treasury market is that that is the quid pro quo. We provide safety. They provide financing. You see?
Right.
We provide safety. They provide financing. If we do not provide safety, what are the political motivations for them to provide financing? So do we see the appetite for U.S. treasuries in Saudi Arabia, in Israel, in Germany, in Taiwan, in Japan? Do we see that diminish? At what point, Kevin, do we, in the name of helping ourselves and moving on to a better world, end up killing ourselves?
Yeah, end up alienating everybody with the very thing that motivated them to finance us in the first place.
I think, Kevin, that over the next few weeks, this is going to be a profound, profound thing to impact the treasury markets and impact, you know, our international relations. Mm. And again, these are the unintended consequences of policy measures. This is a point, one of the points that we make in this year's DVD, which we'll release here in a couple months. One of the points is you take politics and put it in a vacuum and assume that there won't be consequences from it in the fields of finance and economics. And what you are is a professor who doesn't realize that all of these things are, in fact, interconnected. And the practice of public policy can't be in isolation, can't right. be treated as if it's coming from college syllabus, wherein you can look at a particular problem and not see that there are unintended consequences into fields that are beyond your particular coursework, your particular teaching schedule, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and that brings into the point of specialization. Again, to say that this is just a nuclear issue, that's a specialized mentality, but the nuclear issue is actually supportive of our bond market pricing.
Yeah, from the New York Times, for the first time, the United States is explicitly committing not to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states that are in compliance with nuclear non-proliferation treaty, even if they attack the United States with biological chemical weapons or launching a crippling cyber attack. Kevin, we are unhinging our foreign relations as we speak in the name of peace. Mm. And this is flat absurdity. So, Kevin, whether it is the liabilities of the municipalities and states coming onto the balance sheet of the U.S. government, whether it is the bond market speaking already, with interest rates rising and bond prices falling, what's happening on the international scene, we have several things that we've got to digest and as investors incorporate into an investment thesis. Kevin, just to conclude, global sentiment is changing. And the expression of concern with the status quo is best depicted in the decade-long shift towards gold. We're seeing global consumption of gold. We're seeing global disaffection with the U.S.-centric monetary system. And the bond market is just evidence that supports that. But the price of gold runs parallel to the direction of the bond market any longer. They're countercyclical, and the next move forward for both bonds and gold, I think, will be remarkably similar. Up for interest rates and up for the price of gold.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.